This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture. I'm Julia Jacobs. It's our last episode for the year, and I thought we'd take a look back at some of the shows that we covered in 2017. First up, something that made headlines across the world. That's when U.S. President Donald Trump made the announcement that he was pulling the U.S. out of the landmark Paris Agreement. I spoke to Dr. Gudiel Singh Nijjar, the lead spokesman for like-minded developing countries at the COP21, about this. So, I mean, how did you feel when, you know, President Trump finally made that decision to pull the United States out of the Paris Agreement on climate change? I mean, he threatened to do it, you know, all through his presidential campaign. Were you surprised at all?
In a sense, not surprised at all, because I think there are other forces at work also. You see, Trump is really being used as a vehicle by the fossil fuel industry. I was just reading this article by the New Yorker of June 5th, and even Al Gore, in an interview on ABC's very recently, said he cited dark money from fossil fuel companies as the explanation for Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Accord.
Mm-hmm.
And John Kerry, who took a very active role in the Paris Agreement negotiations, on NBC's Meet the Press, he specifically chastised a Kansas-based advocacy group, you know, headed by the Koch family,
as having
got their way in getting Trump to declare the withdrawal.
I mean, the agreement actually hinges on developed countries like the United States, who, you know, historically their economies have contributed more emissions, right?
Yes.
And so it hinges on them helping to finance developing countries' transition to cleaner forms of energy. What exactly did the U.S. commit to in the Paris Agreement under Obama? I mean, very broadly.
Broadly speaking, I think they agreed that the developed countries had to take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they wanted developing countries to come on board, they had to provide what we call the means of implementation, which included the provision of finance for countries to switch from the cheaper coal to renewables, as well as technology transfer to use those technologies that are related to renewables,
mm-hmm.
As well as capacity building. So that was the long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
They have accepted responsibility under the UN Convention on Climate Change for the historical responsibility for having used up, for having created this climate problem because of their over-reliance on fossil fuels since the 1700s.
Yeah.
So they agreed on what they call common but differentiated responsibilities. And it was not only in respect of mitigation, which means, you know, you cut down on coal, and which would spell lot of problems for developing countries because, you know, we use cheaper means. Malaysia, for example,
mm-hmm.
you know, the TNB uses coal for purposes of generating energy for electricity.
Yeah.
And we can imagine all the SMEs, the small and medium enterprises, if they had to switch overnight without any support to renewables, many of them will go out of business. The country's economy, as far as SMEs our concern, will collapse. That is why when we negotiated, we said, fine, you know, we are prepared. We made a commitment under the NDCs, Nationally Determined Contributions, to reduce. Malaysia agreed to reduce by 40% from pre-industrial levels. But we said that for us to switch and switch effectively, it has to be proportionate to the financial aid that they had committed themselves to, mm-hmm. but were not providing.
So now that they've decided to pull out, where does that leave developing countries? I mean, Malaysia in particular.
Well, I mean, the U.S. has pulled out, which means there'll be a big gap in terms of the financial contribution. They're supposed to contribute something like $3
billion. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's what Obama promised, right, about $3
billion. Yes, that's under the Green Climate Fund as their responsibility. Developed countries, the rest of the developed countries will have to step up their contribution. They have not been that, efficient in or responsible in fulfilling their obligations because they had agreed to give $100 billion per year up to 2020. Only $10 billion materialized. And after 2030, and they also did not want any financial commitment to be included in the Paris Agreement itself,
mm-hmm.
but they introduced it by way of a decision after developing countries insisted. And thereafter 2030, they have to also begin to make substantial contributions. Judged by their past record, it's not good. But the expectation now is that Europe and the rest of the developed world will live up to the responsibilities and fill the gap. Mm-hmm. And of course, developing countries, to the extent possible, they are putting in as much as possible. China and India have accelerated their reduction of emissions. China is, I think, 10 years ahead of time. India is also ahead of time by several years. So the lead developing countries like China and India have actually taken on board very seriously their obligations under the Paris Agreement. They're not even obligations. Mm-hmm. They are recommendations, you know. They're advisory in nature. And they have done their bit. But the developed countries now will have to step up. They have indicated that they will step up. Europe, France, and so on, Germany. But now the test of the pudding will lie in the eating, you see.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned China and India, because I think they were mentioned several times as well by President Trump. You know, he listed some of the main reasons why the U.S. was withdrawing was to cut. He said that under the agreement, China will be able to increase the emissions by a staggering number of years, contingent 13. They can do whatever they want for 13 years, not us. India makes its participation contingent on receiving billions and billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid from developed countries. There are many other examples, but the bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level of the United States. Was any of this even true?
I think first it flies in the face of existing evidence. I don't know what his advisors have been telling him, but it is now common ground that China's emissions have peaked more than 10 years sooner than pledged. And India is expected to obtain 40% of its electricity from non-fossil fuel sources by 2022, which is 8 years ahead of schedule. So I don't know what Trump means by spewing out these kind of comments, because they're not correct. And we must not forget that first is, under the UN Convention, developed countries took on the role. The U.S. is the biggest per capita polluter. Yep. All right? They are going on absolute terms, which doesn't make sense. Because 50% of the world's population that is housed in developing countries, out of that, 70% of the world's poorest exist. Yeah. So now, when you talk in terms of absolute figures, it does not make sense, because India and China, their population is vast, 1.4 billion, 1.2 billion, is 2 point something billion. You have to look at per capita, all right? Per capita means how much is being polluted. And if you look at how much each person is emitting, which has to be addressed. And if you look at the figures, you'll find that as far as, if you look at 2015 figures, the U.S. in terms of per capita emission was 16.1 tons. India was 1.9 tons. And China was 7.7 tons. All right?
Okay.
So it's unfair to ask China and India to have the same mitigation targets as the US, because what it means then is that if you ask 1.4 billion to reduce by a certain amount, I mean, they already house a large amount of the poor.
Yeah.
That means they'll have to be sub-poor level. Now, these are the figures that his advisors are not giving out to Trump, or he's ignoring these figures, which we brought about in during the negotiations, highlighted these facts. As a result of that, the Paris Agreement was shaped in the way it was, which is that developed countries, including the largest polluter per capita, which is the U.S., had to take the lead. And other countries, if they could, there was a recommendatory provision that, to the extent possible. Now, China and India and all of the rest of the countries are falling in line. They've already given their national determined contributions, yep, right? They have already made commitments well ahead of time. The U.S. was required to do it between 20 to 26%. Now it is reversed in terms of its national policies. It has reversed a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And it is sending a very bad signal. Although, mercifully, I think, a large number of the states in the U.S., yeah, as well as Fortune 100 companies, a large number of them, according to the New Yorker, have made a commitment to say that they are for the Paris Agreement and they oppose the withdrawal by Trump from the Paris Agreement.
So I suppose then, can they make any difference, you know, regardless of what Trump's decision is, what his decision was?
Well, in a sense, they can because, you know, states determine industrial policies.
Yeah.
So you can, for example, in Malaysia, if Selangor or Penang wants to take certain measures, right, they can do that. Mm-hmm. But there is a big interface with the federal setup.
Exactly.
If the federal setup does not obligate certain measures to be taken, you know, that are beneficial for climate change mm-hmm. Reduction, then you find that at every stage there would be industry that would put up a front opposing whatever measures are going to be taken by the state. So it requires industry to be on board, some industries on board, but the main industry, which is the fossil fuel industry in the US, is against it.
And I mean, you were there, you know, you helped negotiate it. You know, and Trump seems to think that he can negotiate to make a fairer deal. I mean, this was something that was not just an overnight thing, you know, it was almost 20 years of, you know, negotiating and everything. I mean, is it that easy for him to just pull out and say that I want to renegotiate?
Well, first is the pullout, right? Mm-hmm. Countries are allowed to pull out. There is Article 28 of the Paris Agreement, which says that you can withdraw.
Okay.
But there are certain terms attached to the withdrawal. First is you cannot do it. You have to give 3 years. You cannot withdraw until 3 years have lapsed.
Okay.
From the date of the Paris Agreement.
Okay. So this will be
2018.
Yeah.
And then from the date when you notify the secretariat of the convention mm-hmm. Of your withdrawal, it will only come into effect 1 year okay. thereafter, which means we are talking about 26 November 2019.
Right.
So you can't just withdraw, right? The signal that is sent is, oh, we have withdrawn and end of the story. Mm-hmm. But no, they are still members. They are still participating. There was a meeting last week, intersessional meeting of the Paris Agreement. They participated. And they will continue to participate. So that's the first point. Now, as far as renegotiating is concerned, you see, there are 195 countries on board in the climate change, as parties to the climate change Paris Agreement. You can't decide to renegotiate. What you are saying is we want to amend the terms of the Paris Agreement. Now, amendment requires consensus. Mm-hmm. It took a long, hard, rancorous negotiations for the last just 4 years preceding the conclusion of the Paris Agreement. For this to be shaped, it almost fell apart. And it was quite skillful leadership stewardship by the French that I think resulted in the agreement, in the conclusion of the agreement. So to suggest that we can renegotiate, while it might send, you know, beneficial signals to the populace that Trump is addressing, yeah. is not practical. What he's suggesting is that this is while it is a public relations exercise, but in effect what he's saying is he's killing the agreement.
And like you said, a consensus is needed, right? So that means it requires all the other nations' leaders to come together to agree that they want to renegotiate, in essence, is that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and so I don't think that's happening because everyone seems to have come out against what he said.
Yes.
Do you think that this move would then discourage developing nations from taking further steps to limit emissions? I mean, you've spoken about China and India, but what about, you know, other developing countries?
No, I think other developing countries are seriously on board. I mean, you look at the small island developing countries, developing states, SIDS we call them. Mm-hmm. Now, for them, it's a matter of life and death.
Exactly.
So they are very serious in pushing for climate change and for other countries to fulfill their obligations. Large number of developing countries, Malaysia included, are also very much on board. The like-minded developing countries comprised 28 countries, you know, ranging from the smallest like Cuba to the biggest like China, in Malaysia included. So I think this is fortifying the effort of other countries, the resolve of other countries to really push ahead, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But the problem is that because America, US is the largest polluter per capita, without their role, they will effectively, or to a large extent, undermine the ability of the planet to cope with emissions because, you know, we are integrated. There's no boundary, visa required for emissions to spread and cause global warming.
That was Datuk Dr. Gurdial Singh Nija, the lead spokesman for like-minded developing countries at the COP21, sharing his views on President Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement. Coming after this quick break, we revisit a landmark case where the residents of Taman Tun Dr. Ismail, or TTDI, took on DBKL to protect Taman Rimba Kiara from being developed. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's our year-end look-back episode, and now we revisit a chat I had with the residents of Taman Tun Dr. Ismail in KL, who are still actually working hard to prevent Taman Rimba Kiara from being developed. So for some backstory, back in June 2016, actually, Dewan Bandaraya Kuala Lumpur, DBKL, issued a notice of a proposed development on a portion of land situated within Taman Rimba Kiara. Taman Rimba Kiara is one of the few remaining planned public parks of its size in KL. It serves as a very much treasured green lung and open space for thousands of Klang Valley residents. So the Taman Tun Dr. Ismail Residents Association are taking legal action against DBKL to protect Taman Rimba against any proposed development. So here are Hafiz Abubakar from the TTDI Residents Association and Leon Kwe from the Save Taman Rimba Kiara Working Group shedding some light on what's actually happening. Could you just spell out what exactly is in the proposed development?
Well, the proposed development is for building of 8 blocks of service apartments ranging from 42 to 54 stories high, about 1,766 units altogether. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they are also going to build a 29-story block of affordable housing for 350 units altogether. Now, this affordable housing is for supposedly to be given or sold to current residents of the longhouse over there.
Just stop you and ask you who these longhouse residents are exactly and how do they play a role in this context?
Okay. These longhouse residents are previously workers of an rubber plantation estate that where the land was acquired by the government 30, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, they were promised proper housing, but until today, they were not given that facilities for them.
So we're talking about 30 years?
Yes, yes. Okay. It is the onus of the government to provide these settlers the proper housing that they truly deserve.
So they were staying there and then they were asked to move by DBKL?
They were workers there.
They were workers?
Yeah, so the longhouse residents were originally plantation workers. Mm-hmm. They worked the plantations that covered Bukit Kiara. And they worked for basically the previous private owners of what was Bukit Kiara Estates.
Right.
When Bukit Kiara Estates was acquired by the government, these workers were offered to resettle. Previously, they were living deeper in the plantation area, closer to where KLGCC is now. They were offered to resettle into a corner that is next to Taman Rimba Kiara. The offer to resettle was coupled with a promise from the authorities that this would be temporary. We understand that the promise was that it would only be for 5 years and that they would thereafter be given permanent housing. This promise has, as Encik Hafiz said, been unfulfilled for the last 35 to 40 years. The proposed development at Taman Rimba Kiara today leverages, if I may use that word, on this unfulfilled promise to the longhouse residents. The starting point is that this is supposed to be a solution for the longhouse residents. There are 98 families there. The 29-story affordable housing block is supposed to cater to their needs. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 350 units. It's unclear why you need 350 units to deal with the needs of 98 families. But beyond that, the larger proposed development then seeks to build 8 blocks of 42 to 54 stories comprising almost 1,800 units. So the burning question here is, if you only need to solve for the housing needs of 98 families, why do you need to build another 1,800 units, involving tower blocks that are almost the height of Komta in Penang. And not one tower block, 8 tower blocks. You know, it's a question which goes unanswered until today. There are so many affordable housing schemes promulgated and supported by the government all over the country. There is so much funding apparently available for affordable housing all over. But apparently it is a struggle to fund affordable housing for these 98 families because the scheme that is intended to be deployed here is purportedly a cross-subsidy from the sale of the 1,800 units. It's unbelievable because if we use PRIMA guidelines, the cost of building for 98 families is probably somewhere around 40 million ringgit,
mm-hmm.
whereas the contemplated gross development value of this proposed development, if it does happen, is 3 billion ringgit.
If I might add, I'd just like to qualify the fact that the RA is against and opposed this development. But we have to qualify the fact that we are totally not against the building of the permanent residence for the longhouse settlers. In fact, we have been giving messages to the authorities to continue building the affordable housing for the settlers. And also, we are against this development per se because the development will use a plot density of 1 acre to 979 people, whereby the current plot density there is 1 acre to 74 people. So that's a massive increase in plot density to over 1,500%. Now, we all know that Taman Tun is a low-density housing area,
yep.
You know. So people who bought properties there expect to live and retire there in a low-density area. So those property owners who bought properties in Taman Tun will feel cheated by this. All of a sudden, they find in their backyard a monstrous development up to 979 people per acre. Now, if I were, just like would be in probably areas like Mount Kiara, for instance. Now, if I were to buy a piece of land in Mount Kiara and to build myself a bungalow over there, I would be very foolish, knowing very well that that zone is a high-density zone, but not in Taman Tun. You know, Taman Tun is a low-density area. Apart from the proper development itself, which is the 8 blocks of 45 to 54-story high condominiums, it also entails a development of a 6-lane highway that will cut across Taman Tun Dr. Ismail and that will be built upon the present Jalan Datuk Sulaiman. So as far as the RA is concerned, that's a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we discovered that during the public hearing last year. That was not disclosed to us in the notice that was given. Yeah. Now, also, there is this proposed road, or rather a ramp, to be built from where the Istin Hotel is and will go under the current MRT track, under the track,
okay.
over the current sewerage plant into the development. And that road or ramp will connect to the existing Jalan Datuk Sulaiman. And with that development, Jalan Datuk Sulaiman will never be the same again.
Yeah.
We have the canopy trees that's lining up the trees very nicely. And we will see that area to be, as in any highway, will be traffic, lots of them.
So just to elaborate on Encik Hafiz's point, we have 8 blocks of 42 to 54 stories, 1,800 units, next to 29 stories, 350 units. Okay, density of going up from 74 persons per acre to 979 people per acre. Accompanying that is this plan to build a comprehensive road works all around Taman Tun, purportedly to support the influx of residents, influx of 10,000 residents and 5,000 to 6,000 additional cars into Taman Tun. So this is the bizarre thing. You approve a monstrous development, and after that, you approve or you put up a proposal to build very comprehensive roadworks all around Taman Tun in order to justify the traffic that is going to be brought in by this monstrous development. It's kind of bootstrapping each other. It's a bit weird. It's a bit of an aberration, I would say. Now, part of this roadworks involves building a new flyover that comes in from Jalan Damansara next to the Bukit Kiara Muslim Cemetery that will snake in underneath the new MRT line that's just been built. Mm-hmm. We've just built a new MRT line, and these guys are proposing to build a flyover underneath that MRT line that lands inside Taman Tun on Jalan Wan Kadeh, just next to the park, and connects to Plaza Veds, which used to be IBM building, and then runs all along Jalan Datuk Sulaiman, all the way connecting to Pencala Link.
Okay, that's massive.
It's a very massive piece of work. They're estimating 80 million ringgit for this work. And they're looking at 6 to 8 lanes, broadening it to 6 to 8 lanes. Now, if you broaden it to 6 to 8 lanes, number one, they're planning to build over the existing monsoon drain. This monsoon drain in Taman Tun, I mean, the reason Taman Tun is famous is because it was well planned. This monsoon drain was built to last 100 years. It has never been a flood in Taman Tun until today. But they're planning to build over the monsoon drain and narrow it. They might deepen it, but it will narrow the monsoon drain. So that's going to be a big problem. On top of that, they're looking at, as part of the widening, basically you're going to narrow all the dividers and you're going to cut all the trees along Jalan Datuk Sulaiman and Jalan Wan Kadeh. Now, Taman Tun is famous for its tree-lined canopy. People enter Taman Tun and feel a sense of peace and tranquility precisely because of the tree canopy that's there. I remember entering Taman Tun in the 90s as a young guy on a motorbike and being inspired by this beautiful tree canopy and thinking to myself, this is where I want to live. And that's the wanton destruction that we are looking at or contemplating if this proposed development happens. There's no consideration at all as to what is the character of Taman Tun. What is the soul of what makes a place like this livable and desirable? What is it that makes these people, want to live in a particular community? All of that is being ignored, if you like. Yeah, and it's all side effects from this originally monstrous attempt to build on a public park.
That was Hafiz Abubakar from the TTDI Residents Association and Leon Kwe from the Save Taman Rimba Kiara Working Group. We take another quick break, but when we return, a personal favourite of mine, a snippet of an interview I did with Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute. Do stay tuned. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. It's our year-end roundup for the series, and we're just looking back and revisiting some episodes that we've done through 2017. So I had the pleasure of speaking to Richard Heinberg twice this year. Richard is an American journalist and educator specialized in energy, economic, and ecological issues. He's also a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, and Richard is considered one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. So here's part of our chat. You wrote in a previous article that techno fix and power down, if they were to be put to a vote today, there's little doubt which side would win. Maybe you could could you elaborate on those two terms and what you meant by that statement?
Well, power down is a shorthand term that I've used. I actually wrote a book with that title.
Yes, you did.
Back in 2004. Power down, as I describe it, is a deliberate policy of reducing the rate at which we're doing just about everything. Mm-hmm. First of all, reducing the amount of energy that we're using. And I think this is going to be absolutely necessary. I don't think there's any way out, really, because fossil fuels, as I said earlier, are finite, depleting resources, and that's catching up with us in real time. I can talk about that more. But also, even if we switch to renewable energy, the fact is we're not going to be able to build enough capacity fast enough. And solar and wind power have fundamentally different characteristics from fossil fuels as energy sources. So realistically, our renewable energy future is going to be one in which we will have a lot less energy available. I wrote about a book about this too. It's called Our Renewable Future. I co-authored it with David Fridley, who's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Mm-hmm. And this was a conclusion of a year-long study of, you know, just what a full transition to renewable energy would almost certainly look like. So if we're going to have less energy available, it makes overwhelming sense to start the preparation now, to start figuring out how to meet basic human needs with much less energy usage. And in all areas of society, including transportation, mm-hmm. Agriculture, manufacturing, those are the three biggies. Of course, buildings also, how we keep ourselves warm and cool and comfortable.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, right now we're not doing that. Whenever we benefit from energy efficiency in the economy as it's working now, what happens is that we use the benefits of that efficiency to expand our consumption in other areas.
Yep.
So that's not power down. That's business as usual. I'm talking about an actual reduction in overall energy consumption. And if we do that, that will drive changes in other aspects of the economy. We will end up consuming less stuff because we use energy to extract materials and transform them into consumer products. And so if we have less energy, if we're using less energy, then we'll be doing a lot less of that extracting and transforming as well.
But, you know, capitalism, we're addicted to growth. You know, we want more. We're told to consume more, to waste mm-hmm. more, you know, because that's, you know, that's what the economy demands, isn't it?
I know. And, you know, that's the poison pill. We had the chance back in the 1970s. There was this famous study, Limits to Growth, in 1972, mm-hmm. which was an early attempt to use computer modeling to create scenarios for what the future might look like in terms of industrial output, population, pollution, agricultural output. And the people who did these studies, you know, they tried to tweak the input variables any way they could, you know, doubling Earth's resources. And no matter what they did, the end result seemed to be a peak and decline in world industrial output, agricultural output, and human population before the middle of this century. Now, of course, you know, politicians and mainstream economists thought this was just horrible, the very thought that there could be limits to growth. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, President Reagan had this famous quote saying, there are no limits to growth as long as there's human imagination and ingenuity and so on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's a very reassuring kind of sentiment. But, you know, the MIT scientists who did this study, they weren't looking at human imagination and ingenuity. They were looking at arable land and the capacity for Earth's atmosphere to absorb wastes and, you know, finite measurable things like that. And the reality is we live on a limited planet.
Yeah.
So you can't grow the economy endlessly on a finite planet as long as growth entails real physical factors like energy and materials. And, you know, sadly, that very simple realization didn't sink in because of the economists and the politicians who attacked limits to growth falsely back in 1972. We've wasted these intervening decades increasing the size of our consumption and reducing our options for adaptation in the future.
Is there evidence that controlled degrowth is possible? I mean, maybe you could help paint that out.
Well, it's happening in a number of countries around the world. I mean, population degrowth is happening in Japan and Italy and several other countries. And some countries are seeing economic decline. We were just talking about Puerto Rico. Yeah. Now, of course, this is also always seen as a tragedy, but we should be seeing it as test cases and opportunities. Now, one aspect of economic decline is that how we're doing it right now is that when economies start to decline, the rich people get antsy and scared, and they say, well, you know, we've got to get ours. And because rich people tend to be more politically powerful than poor people, what happens is in countries where economies are stagnating or declining, economic inequality tends to increase.
Yes.
And that makes the situation much worse. But over the course of the last few decades, we've used economic growth to make economic inequality palatable. Mm-hmm. In countries like China, for example, economic inequality has been growing rapidly, but as long as there's more and more wealth to go around, as long as the pie is growing, then people can be convinced that it's okay if economic inequality is growing because, you know, a rising tide will lift all boats. Well, when the tide stops rising, the only way to keep social pressures from exploding into, you know, revolutions and coups and all sorts of, you know, social violence is to reverse that equation. Only increasing economic equity is going to be, you know, socially functional in societies that are no longer growing or that are contracting. So in response to economic contraction, the first thing we need to do is go toward greater economic inequality.
So, you know, you've said that our problems, you know, they're growing faster than the solutions. And, you know, if technology were going to solve our biggest problem, surely we'd be seeing some evidence by now. Why do you think our technological solutions aren't working?
Well, you know, some of them just are pie in the sky. They're not going to work. You know, people have been proposing technologies for a long time, some of which, you know, turn into huge successes and moneymakers like smartphones, and others like flying cars. You know, people have been talking about flying cars as being the future of transportation since the 1960s, and it's never caught on because, you know, you look at it from an engineering standpoint, and it's just, you know, it's never going to work because, you know, from an engineer standpoint, what makes for a good automobile makes for a terrible airplane and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so some of the technologies that we're appealing to are in that latter category, and carbon capture and storage is one of those, whether it's, you know, bolting carbon capture and storage onto coal power plants or whether it's, you know, growing vast amount of forest products and other kinds of agricultural products that we can then, you know, burn and capture the carbon and sequester it. You look at this technology in realistically, and it just doesn't make sense to capture a significant portion of the carbon that we're releasing right now from coal power plants would require an infrastructure roughly on the same scale as the global oil and gas infrastructure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we're talking about thousands of miles of pipelines and thousands of compressors and pumps to move carbon around and ultimately bury it somehow. And who's going to pay for all that? And what will be the side effects, the impacts on land use and all the rest from doing that? Certainly, the impacts of the oil and gas industry are not negligible. So you look at that and you go, yeah, maybe theoretically that's possible, but doesn't it just make more sense to use less coal? Yeah. Or to, you know, use less energy to produce less carbon in the first place?
Yeah, because, you know, like you said, clearing the land, degrading the land, I think that that direct impact, you know, upon the land is something that's even more important than maybe even climate change at the moment. You know, that's like a death by a thousand cuts almost.
And this relates to overpopulation as well.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as we are growing the population, we have to have more food. I know that there's the argument that, you know, if we all went to a vegetarian diet, then that would free up agricultural space for more people. And that's true in principle. And I don't see a widespread movement to, you know, force everybody to a vegetarian diet. It's
exactly.
I just don't think it's going to happen. So realistically, if we want to preserve space for other creatures, and if we want to have a decent life for the people in future generations, then we just need fewer people making demands on the planet.
I guess then, you know, how do we actually, you know, initiate a conversation about this, you know, about moving beyond, you know, techno-fixed solutions and begin the process of negotiation and behavior change?
Yeah. Well, there's no easy answer to this. But one thing I think we could do to start with is get the environmental organizations, which have had a tremendous influence so far in terms of public consciousness and public policy, get them back to their first principles. You know, as I said earlier, environmental organizations back in the 1970s and 1980s were making this fundamental moral argument about limits and about human wants and desires, rates of consumption, population, and so on.
Yeah.
And then mostly just kind of backed off from that because they decided it was politically not desirable. Well,
or perhaps the message wasn't being easily accepted, right? Because it's not an easy
right.
message.
But, you know, if we have any chance of still making a soft landing by accepting this ethical challenge and following through on it, somebody has to champion it. And it has to be the environmental movement doing that. So, first of all, I think we need to challenge the environmental movement to come back to first principles and be honest with the rest of us about what's actually required. That's a first step. And then as we've done that, then I think we need to use experiences as they come up, events as they arise, like the hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico and Puerto Rico, and we're still at the beginning of what is going to inevitably be a long string of climate and other kinds of disasters, challenges. Each one of those is going to be a learning opportunity, and we need to, those of us in the environmental movement, need to be ready with the arguments, with the solutions, and just hammer away at them and not let up. Because really, this is our last and only chance. You know, we've dithered for the last 40 or 50 years since the Limits to Growth study, and we didn't do what we could have in order to avert a lot of the suffering that's now more or less going to be baked into the cake for the remainder of our century. But that doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. Intervention at any point along the line is going to prevent human suffering and save other species. And we need to be doing as much of that as we possibly can from here on out. If we just, you know, fold up our hands and all become cynics and say, well, the world's going to hell and we can't do anything about it. And we tried and it didn't work. That's really the coward's way out, and I think we'll have a lot to answer for if we do that.
That was journalist, author, and educator Richard Heinberg, who is also a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute in the US. So that's it for this year. Earth Matters will resume on Monday, January the 8th at 3 p.m. If you'd like to listen to any of our previous interviews, please download the BFM app and search for Earth Matters, or you can find the podcast online at bfm.my/earth. If you have feedback or suggestions for the show, I would love to hear from you. Just drop me an email at biggerpicture@bfm.my, or you can follow us, the whole Bigger Picture team on our Facebook page. You just search for The Bigger Picture on facebook.com. So that's it. Have a wonderful Christmas to those celebrating, and a very happy new year to everyone, and we'll see you next year. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.